Hey, everybody.
Let me tell you guys that I am so excited. I am so happy.
Point. I actually wanted to make that point, but you made it for me. It was,
it's sorry.
It's no, but it's exactly what I was thinking of. It's like, I think there are two trends that currently nobody's really, they're not in headlines or whatnot. But like what you mentioned is like, I think that the biggest beneficiaries in terms of like, the biggest beneficiaries of this trend where, hey, I don't have to hire a person from New York for this job. I guess at least the jobs that are not super, jobs that are where you don't need somebody who you trust too much, because it's also one problem with hiring people online is that, yes, you can hire a person online, but you're hiring basically somebody of a video camera. It's not the same level of intimacy, at least now. Maybe in 10 years, there is some kind of a VR thing where we can feel exactly the same as we're in person. So at least for the jobs that are not super high ranking, I think companies, as we outsourced before, the car makers, the Nikes of the world and whatnot, I think US companies are going to start outsourcing coding, all kinds of stuff. And I think that's a threat to the United States, to the American worker. And then because you're competing with people who can definitely live off a lower wage, which is, again, it's a deflationary pressure, because if you have to compete and you get paid lower, that's going to have an interesting pull on the deflationary side. But I think that the countries that are going to be great beneficiaries of this are going to be countries that are English speaking, but outside of of United States or UK or whatnot, like India, where people have their first language is English. They've grown up with English, but they can actually communicate well, completely normally, and they can do the work. There's no problem. There's no barrier. I think that's interesting. And I think that the second trend is that might be happening as well is that I think like in the beginning of the 20th and like 19th century and whatnot, people especially moved into the cities after the Industrial Revolution to stay together, because there's no other way to be with too many people at one place. I wonder if this is a beginning of, I would say, a multi-decade development in technology where me and Fraser don't have to be in the same room to record the podcast. It's actually better. The sound quality is better if we do it over Zoom. Everything is automatically recorded. We can do everything over our computers, no problem. Do we still have that necessity of, hey, I need to be somewhere geographically where there are these many people if we can all be together in the digital world? So those are the two things that I think are happening, and we're not discussing them too much.
Yeah, no, I've heard that before from other sources, and I think that's it's to be watched. I do think that human beings need proximity to each other, and that there is something lost over the Zoom feed. And I don't know what it is. It's more of a hunch or sort of a, you know, finger in the air type thing. But I think there's an appetite for people to be around other people, and that, so there'll be a minor swing of the metronome back to having people in close quarters, if only because it's a little bit different from that sort of isolated experience we've all felt. I'll throw one more trend on there that you might find interesting that I picked up from Twitter, from Ramp Capital and Jim O'Shaughnessy, who are big Twitter guys and good follows for anybody listening. And that is the concept that the resume is going to evolve from having, you know, going to an Ivy League school or something like that as being proof of competence, to actual work as being proof of competence. That Zoom and the ability to communicate digitally and so on, I think it's opened up the concept that if you're able to prove work through a project that you publish, that is going to be your calling card in getting hired going forward to a greater extent than the traditional resume has been. And then, so that's not really a new concept, but something that those two espouse a little bit. And I would add on to that, that, you know, people, the rank and file worker is much more in the media industry than they know, because I think that social media, regular media, however it plays itself out, I think that proof of work concept, where being able to do the actual job, not having the certification to say that you're smart enough to do the job, is going to be important. But I think the public persona that one puts out there is going to be proof of culture, that one is going to be able to function within the business organization's tenets. And I think that's going to be something going forward that HR departments are going to have to wrestle with, hiring's going to have to wrestle with, and in conjunction with what we're talking about, if the global workforce truly has become global, and that you don't have to fly people and have them work in New York or at the home office in Cincinnati or something like that, you're going to need to find ways to figure out whether you can deal with them or not. And that sort of proof of work, proof of culture dynamic is going to be something that is going to, take a different form than the resume. And it'll be interesting to see what that looks like. That's not to say that resumes aren't going to be important. They convey certain information, but I think most people would agree that they're a blunt tool. And then that blunt tool is then backed up by an interview process, which is also a blunt tool. And ultimately, at least in many of the jobs I've been involved with and hired for and been hired for, et cetera, whether one can do the job is not really ascertained in that process. It's sort of listed out there. But if you have some sort of proof of work out there that shows what you're capable of on a project, or you know, whether you wrote a book on something or have a podcast and people can figure out how you communicate, that in conjunction with how you behave yourself in the world is going to be a much larger part of the hiring process than has been a part so far.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. And I would add one point is, I think one thing that might contribute to that as well is decentralization of information in general. Because before, let's say in the 90s, even if you were a teacher or a professor, the only way you could technically make your money is by teaching at a university. But now they're like, I don't know if you know Lex Fridman, for example, and he teaches at MIT, and these kind of younger generations of professor and whatnot, you can technically just go out on YouTube. And if you're, of course, if you're able enough to create your following and be a businessman as well, a businesswoman or a man, you could technically make your money and teach that to the internet. And then the people who join in your course and maybe pay, you know, $5 per week or something like that, they can get the same type of information that the person at MIT could get. Of course, not in person, and you don't get extra hours and whatnot. But I would say that limits to some extent, it limits the competitiveness of a degree if all of a sudden the same teacher can teach everybody globally the same thing. Of course, being in the same classroom, competing with people working together, there's like a whole other area that you'll never, at least for now, you can't recreate online. But I think that's something interesting that might add to your point.
It makes total sense. I mean, if the education process goes online as well, that is a different, it's a different experience that I grew up with, all the way through law school and with all the different relationships I made along the way. But it's something that we've all gotten a crash course in it with Zoom Nation here. And it's we don't know what those long-term effects are going to be, but they will be significant, in my opinion.
Yeah. So with all of these, I guess we went over a bunch of things and a bunch of changes that were happening and analyzed them. But with everything that's happening, everything that we mentioned, how does an investor allocate their funds? And I'm not saying that this is a recommendation, but how should the investor think about allocating their funds in such a market?
I go back to my standard training on this and working for a trust company and advising people. It's really go back and understand what your goals are first. What are your income needs? What needs to happen this year? What needs to happen in 5 years, what needs to happen in 10 and 20 years, supporting family, buying a house, getting colleges paid for. If you're further up the food chain, do you have philanthropic situations you need to take care of? Do you want to save for your grandkids, et cetera? Then once you've kind of laid out what those goals are, I'm a big fan of putting buckets around those goals and saying, okay, here is a chunk of money that is in service of those goals. So if one of your goals is to make a house payment or a down payment on a house that you want to purchase, I'm just picking a number out of the air. Let's say you've saved $250,000 for that, and you expect to purchase the house in a year or two. I would not be taking really any risk with that money, because if you go backward with that, that is going to create a significant crimp in that particular goal. So to go from 250 to 200, all of a sudden causes you a lot of problems in your house buying process. That's that bucket. So sort of extrapolate that onto other things. A bucket that most people are worried about is retirement. And retirement, often I'm 47 years old. I've got hopefully another couple decades before I have to, I'll probably be pulled off my desk, but I have a long enough time horizon that I'm willing to take risk in the form of equity investment, but short enough in some ways that I don't want to have to recover from a 50% downdraft. So asset allocation for me is important. It can be aggressive in that particular bucket, which is fine. I can withstand some volatility. I just can't withstand huge volatility in that particular world. And then you just sort of bucket it out accordingly. And there are some pockets of money where I take more risk because I think maybe the investments are fun, or I think I know something. And so that's one area. And then, I like the idea of having a cash cushion when things go haywire, or to participate in something that might be opportunistic. And by opportunistic, for some people out there, and I don't really do much of this at all, but cryptocurrencies or NFTs or meme stocks or something, that's kind of where I would think about it that way. So starting whatever the buckets are and however they fit together for a particular investor, I think you need to have a good, broad, overall asset allocation plan. Divide between stocks and bonds and whatever else you're investing in, and have the guardrails around that, so that when you have these sort of, let's call it, whirlwinds of confusion, where the data is all over the place, you don't know what to do. Do I buy crypto here? Do I sell my stocks there? I've got this goal, my kids are going to college next year. I don't want that to go away. What do I do? By putting in the guardrails around that, I think that's an important component before you try to time or sort of mete out the different risks that are out there. Now, I'm not trying to avoid your question, but so against that backdrop, I would say that for people who are invested in equity and so on, I would align my equity investments in as long a time horizon bucket as possible, because I think we are going to see volatility over the short to medium term, and that there will be downdrafts. You don't want to be in a position where you have to sell at the bottom. And I would just strongly encourage, in the construction of those asset allocations, that those equity positions are in goals that are longer time horizon oriented, where you can withstand the volatility. And then for those that are shorter, and then sort of bond returns and cash-like instruments that you have ready access to, I would keep my duration on fixed income somewhat short. I think if interest rates move up, we're not going to have a whole lot of warning when that happens. And for people who like to invest in bonds, that normally causes your bond portfolios to drop. And against all of that backdrop, for those clients that are either on the verge of retiring or who rely on their assets for income, that is the toughest question out there right now, because We're looking at tax rates potentially going up. We have low interest rates currently to search for yield, to be more aggressive in terms of trying to acquire yielding assets. We're in a tough spot right now. That's a popular problem. And a popular problem means that there's a lot of money flowing to it, which means that it becomes expensive. That one, I don't have a great answer for. I think that I would try to really err on the side of safety in the fixed income market. And in many ways, I've been wrong about interest rates for the last 5 or 6 years now, maybe even longer than that, saying, well, they've got to go up. It's generationally low, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's wrong. The government has put their foot on interest rates. And for those people in fixed income who've been waiting for that time when they could deploy accordingly, it's never really come. The other side of that is on the equity component. I hesitate to use equities as a proxy for fixed income, but for those people, you know, if dividend yield is important, that might be a source. But again, I would err on the side of caution there. A final note would be, I don't think it's ever a bad idea to quote unquote have enough cash. I think that we're in a weird climate right now, and having liquidity might be a nice position to be in, either to withstand a storm or to take advantage of something that's out there if the conditions present itself right.
Yeah, I agree. And you made many great points, especially on the fixed income side. Many people are saying that the bond market is, I mean, we know that the interest rates are at I think a couple of decades low, 40 years, 50 years. It's a huge bull market for the bonds. It's very interesting to see. I know that a couple of investors that made a point where at least in the short term, and I'm familiar with bonds, but I'm not an expert in terms of long-term, short-term durations and whatnot. But the point that they had was that the Fed might be forced to keep the short-term duration ones at a low interest rates, just because the government has to make their own payments because they're in debt, a lot of debt. So they might have to continue buying them, which could go into a spiral where to buy more treasury bonds, you will have to print more money. So the dollar goes down and whatnot in order to artificially keep those rates down. I don't know if you have an opinion about that.
Yeah, no, it's again, kind of that interrelated mess where when you're trying to guess what happens from an interest rate perspective, you could stub your toe because there are forces out there that don't really care what happens to interest rates, or they do care, but they're going to do something that doesn't jibe with economic conventional wisdom. Ultimately, you know, if I were to sort of sit back and say, what's good advice, I would say now is a good time to, in your own mind and in your own allocations, have enough cash to withstand a stormy couple of years. I think there's plenty of room for the economy to grow. I think there's plenty of room for stocks to perform well. If there's $4 trillion being spent on infrastructure, there's probably a ton of opportunities there where government money is going to be going to companies to build roads and digital and all those different things. But personally speaking, having the liquidity to withstand weirdness out there, I don't think is ever a bad idea.
Yeah, and I would like to make a point, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like what I get from basically what you've said so far is that a lot of people come either ask me, and I'm not an advisor or anything of that, but just by being in finance or having any relation to finance, where to invest my money, what to do with the money. And I would say that at least from what I got from you is that the investing is more about yourself as a person, and investing for everybody is different, depending on where are you in terms of your own goals, where are you in terms of age, are you 70 years old, are you in retirement, are you a young person who can, maybe you have your health, you're good, maybe you can risk money and put all of your money in Bitcoin and let's see what happens. And if you lose all of your money, guess what? You're going to live another day. Your $2,000 will be wiped out, but you'll make them at some point in your life. Versus if you made, I don't know, millions of dollars, you don't want to really risk too much. You want to leave some heritage to your family. So it seems that investing is, it's not only as simple as like, oh, buy this, buy that. It's more of like, what are your goals? Who are you? And then derive from there what you should do, right?
Yeah, it's exactly right. I think that the concept is to have a broader overall investment plan so that if you get knocked around a little bit, your lifestyle and your goals don't go backwards significantly. I tell people all the time who are looking for what I would call cocktail party investments. It's like, oh, you know, should I buy Bitcoin or should I buy art or, you know, a Mickey Mantle rookie baseball card or something like that? Is that the right, you know, is that the way to go? That wouldn't be right for me personally, but in the context of someone's personal situation, if you have 5% set aside to play around with it, that's where that should go. And that's the idea of putting guardrails around the different goals that you have in life so that, if you make a bet, it isn't so big that if it blows up, it doesn't crater, your overall financial picture. And that's, to be more helpful to your listeners, if they're saying, well, I do have 5%, what do you think is an interesting investment? There's a lot of talk around sort of the cryptocurrency, NFTs, things like that. One thing that I think would be, and I'm not quite sure how to invest in this exactly, but an event that has taken place recently that has completely changed in industry, and we haven't even seen the full ramifications of this yet, has been a Supreme Court case that has allowed college athletes to take on certain endorsement deals. Mm-hmm. And I just saw a stat today that the new Alabama quarterback is probably going to have $1 million in deals, endorsement deals, before he even sets foot on campus. That is a significant change from the last 40 years in a big situation. And I think that there's room for a lot of entrepreneurism in that space. I think there is room for large media companies, large agency companies, people who could represent athletes or the brands that they would support, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think there is a huge fountain of untapped entrepreneurism that has just been undone within the last month. That if I were telling a younger person, especially, to say, it's like, well, you know, where's their opportunity? I'd say, you know what? I'd take a look at that, because I think there's a whole bunch of change happening there that no one really knows anything about, and that might be a source of opportunity.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I bet that already there's a Gary V type of persons already kind of working with those athletes. You know, I think he and his brother represent a lot of professional sports athletes, and I guess they're for sure they're gonna go and check out these young stars who not only are they going to be fruitful currently when they're in their college teams, but there is a potential for this person to go from being a college star to being, I don't know, a famous NFL player, or being like a NBA star or whatnot. So,
and beyond too. I mean, these kids now, you know, if you go into college and you're supported, mm-hmm. And you know, even wealth management firms, it's going to be a new niche that they're going to have to look at. It's like, okay, I now need to look at the college athlete, because some of them have real money now, and that's new. You had to wait until they graduated, or wait until they signed their first pro contract, or what have you, in order to do that. By the same token, I'd add that it is probably schools competing for different athletes, the costs of doing that have now gone up because Alabama competing with the rest of the SEC or Duke competing with the rest of the basketball world to create a competitive team, they're going to have to be able to appeal to those athletes, not just on the value of the diploma or the campus experience, but also on the dollars that they can get to them from an endorsement standpoint. That's now table stakes. And I think that that's changed that climate a little bit. And so there's going to be a lot of competition in and amongst that. And I'd be interested to see what the TV networks look like. I think two things happen. I think sort of the major sports, basketball and football, those are going to get more expensive and complicated. But I think the availability of the lower sports to drive revenue toward the athletes is going to be different. And I bring up the example of lacrosse, which never really was able to break through. Well, it's starting to now. Paul Rabel, who's a really interesting person to listen to as he's building his lacrosse league. But professional lacrosse has not been a real moneymaker. But there have been stars. Going back to when I was in college, the Gate brothers were major stars, and then the Powells and Paul Rabel, and there's dozens of others. And they would never been able to generally make a living in the sport. But I think that's now going to change. If you're able to be a brand ambassador for something that's not lacrosse industry related, you could see the development of these non-revenue sports at the college level start to emerge. And that's something where I would say, you know, for a young person, I'd say, you know, I'd take a look at that. There is a huge amount of change that's happening there. And if you look at, you know, even Barstool Sports is an example of that, where you have this whole media company that has mushroomed out of a lot of local reporting. And they've been bought by Penn Gambling, so they have a broader revenue stream now attached to what they're doing. But that's an example of a change in an industry that was really sort of ESPN and Disney and the major networks and the major sponsors. All of that, I think, is going to undergo a big change. So that might be an opportunity.
Yeah. And I think the Barstool Sports example just proves your point. It's kind of the fact that they're there and they're doing what they're doing is just, I think, like a proof of what you were saying. And I think another thing that's a factor is social media these days. I think even if you're a great football player and you're in a small school, but you make a viral video on TikTok or something where you, I don't know, you're crushing a guy, like you run through him or something, you can all of a sudden get 2 million followers. And even though you're in a small school, you might have people coming and offering you deals just because, hey, now you have two million people looking at your profile. Whatever you put or advertise out there, it's going to make a lot of money. So it's really interesting how things are developing, right?
Well, that social media part not only could expand college athletic opportunities, but also independent sponsorship opportunities, like you just said. So, and it goes back to what I was saying before. People are now in the rank and file person nowadays is in the media industry, whether they know it or not. And I think that efforts and businesses that support people and help them become brands and that type of thing. And I hate using that word brand, but I think it does make sense that people have to take care of their public persona because it impacts the jobs and their opportunities that they're going to have going forward. That there's opportunity there. Dollars will flow.
Yep. I completely agree. Well, Fraser, thank you so much. I think we covered everything from inflation to sports, to college sports, to trends and moves in all of these different areas. But I think they're all kind of encompassed and they're all affected by similar pulls and pushes and things that trends that are happening in the economy. And it's, I think you gave so many great examples of like, hey, this is how it happens in football. You know, this is how it happens in sports. This is what's happening in the markets. This will happen in the real estate market. So I think it was at least for me, a very insightful conversation. And I would just say, this is how we usually conclude any podcast. Do you have any last words and any message that we send out to the listeners?
No, we never got to billionaires shooting off into space or anything like that. So I guess we stayed
question.
Earthbound.
On which side are you? Are you on the side of billionaires shooting out into space, or are you on the side of progress, of generally progress towards space and making that a commercialized, like our civilization moving forward to commercializing space and going to space as a more normal thing?
Well, I think that it's such a capital intensive exercise that any support of space endeavors is welcome to me personally. So I look at it and say I applaud Branson and Musk and Bezos in going up there. You know, the tougher question is, should they be using their resources for more pressing issues at home? And that's a tougher one. And that's, you know, it's ultimately their money. Is that more of a society problem? Probably. But space excites me. And I think that a lot of the leaps that humanity has made have been in furtherance of looking out at the stars and wanting to do more. Some people don't believe that. I happen to, and I like it. I think it's a leading edge initiative that bears so much fruit and is a multiplier of so many different things that we won't live to see, frankly. But I applaud it, and I wish them the best. So.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it shows us in what kind of a income disparity environment we really are, where that the highlight of the whole thing, that the fact that we are able to send rockets, land them back, where there's no, it used to be a jet that takes the space shuttle, and then the space shuttle flies and the whole thing's going to pieces. Now you see these rockets, and it looks like from a sci-fi movie, the rocket is navigating themselves back. It's slowly landing and can be reused. Or Richard Branson, who is trying to make commercial flights. So imagine, like, in 10 years, as you can sit on a jet, you can go and see the space, which I think will have a great impact on your perception, at least for the people. But at the same time, I think that people, there is such an income disparity that maybe the mistake of this is actually putting Bezos and putting Branson in those planes, because they maybe thought it's going to be a good marketing stunt. But in the current times, maybe let's not put the richest guy in the world enjoying his time in space. Let's send the astronauts. You know, you can go later when we solve these things. But it's weird. I didn't anticipate the backlash, but. Yeah, I agree with you.
I don't know if it's a weird backlash. It's not. I'm not surprised, but I am. They did it. They're the ones who created it. And you know, I agree that it probably is going to end up being a pretty dumb PR stunt. And if they thought they were getting marketing value out of it, probably not. But you know, that I don't think they're too worried about it. They're going to you know, push on and do what they want to do, and hopefully those efforts and the technology that they're creating help take us along for the ride.
Yeah, and you can argue, even for the problems on Earth, you don't like global warming, we can do mining and oil mining and all the oil extraction and all that stuff. Let's do it on Mars and let's live on Earth. You know, so you don't have to pollute one planet. You can use the other one and kind of diversify. At least it seems like, as a species, it makes sense to diversify and live on different planets. If one gets hit by a meteor, we don't all just die out. It's like a portfolio when you invest. You want to be in different assets. Maybe as a species, you want to be in different planets and solar systems, because you don't want to get destroyed by like one piece of bad luck. No, that's how I see it. Maybe I'm just brainwashed.
Interplanetary diversification. I like it.
Imagine how many assets would exist there. How many markets would exist?
Plenty. That's for sure. Terrific.
Perfect. Well, Fraser, it was a pleasure to have you on as always, and hopefully to have you on back soon again. And for everyone who's listening, thank you very much for listening. I think the last thing, where can our listeners find you?
Sure. FraserRice.com. That's where my podcast and blog reside. The podcast is called Wealth Actually. I also have a book called Wealth Actually, and I am on LinkedIn, and I'm on Twitter at Fraser Rice, FrazerRice.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Great. Thanks, Vlad. Thanks for having me on.